This is a podcast for Wednesday, February 16th, 2011, Theories of Knowledge. So last time we were talking about W.K. Clifford and the ethics of belief. And just to review, Clifford, why don't I get someone in class here to go over, if you were to summarize Clifford's viewpoint on the ethical dimensions of belief, what would you say? What would be his main points in that essay? Just throw out, like, in a sentence or two. Yes,
that it's, Alicia. It's our duty, essentially, to investigate information, and that it's immoral, wrong in a way, to not investigate and to spread false beliefs.
Well put. It's your duty to investigate, to find out whether something's true before you believe it. And not just before you act on it, but before you give your mental assent. There's this term assent, which means mental agreement. So it's just when you're basically forming a belief. So before you make a decision to believe something, whatever it is, it's your duty to check it out, to make sure it's true, and to make sure it's worthy of your assent. And he has a little bit where he says, lest your belief fall upon a worthy object and create a stain which can never be wiped away. Right, so that's the moral wrong part. It's morally wrong to give your assent to beliefs that you have no evidence for. Right, somebody else. What are some of his other arguments? That's sort of the main point. His main thesis in the piece. Well, how about are your beliefs your own business?
No,
you don't have a right. You don't have a right to believe whatever you want. Clifford actually argues that your beliefs are public, because if you have a belief, it's going to affect your behavior. And if you speak about your belief, or even if you act on your belief in a personal way, that's going to affect other people. Like, for example, people who are vegetarians, right? You show up at Thanksgiving dinner and you don't put any turkey in your plate. And people are looking at you, and someone says, "Oh, here, have some turkey." And you say, "Oh no, I don't eat turkey." And then even if you said, "That's right, I don't have any turkey on my plate." You don't have to even tell the person I don't eat turkey. They can just look at you by your behavior. They're like, "Oh, why isn't Jeff having turkey?" And they say, "What's the matter with my turkey? Is it too dry for you?" You say, "No, I don't eat turkey. I have a more problem with factory farms," right? And so if that's a view, and you didn't even have to add that. You could just say, "Well, I'm a vegetarian for ethical reasons," or you can just say, "I'm a vegetarian," right? But you don't even have to say, "I'm a vegetarian." If people notice that you're not eating meat, it's going to be sort of something that people will notice. And any belief, which is a significant belief, will find its way into your behavior. People are going to notice it. And then if you spout off about it, that's going to spread even more. And Clifford's point is that your belief is not a private, personal thing. It's a public thing. And so you should think about are my beliefs justified? Because if you go around spreading baseless superstition or unjustified beliefs of various sorts, that is the same as spreading a baseless rumor. Some vicious rumor about some group or person that isn't true. And you see this on the internet all the time. People send it. Anybody ever send you, you get these long-winded spiels like Andy Rooney. Andy Rooney is a big left-winger. He hates everything conservative and Republican. So somebody took this right-wing screed about all the things that's wrong with America, and it's obviously from a more of a right-wing point of view and kind of like a sort of conservative, almost nativist position, right? And he's railing against the government and some stuff about immigrants, and then it's supposed to be Andy Rooney sounds off in America, and it's written in that kind of curmudgeonly tone that Andy Rooney has, but he never said any of this stuff. And I get this stuff all the time, and I send back to people I know and people that you think would be more thoughtful, even my colleagues here at the college. And you send me this stuff, I'm like, Andy Rooney would never say this. Andy Rooney is like a left-wing atheist. And you're sending me this this sort of religious conservative screed, and you shouldn't be passing this around to everyone, because, you know, and think about if you were Andy Rooney. You'd be pretty upset that people are sending this thing around that's got your name on it that you never even said. And the people that write these emails, I don't even know what they're thinking. I think this idea is they get kind of street cred by putting a famous person's name on their email. And this is true, that people see, oh, Andy Rooney, I know who Andy Rooney is. Oh, this is pretty good. I'm going to send it out to all my friends. And, hey, look at what Andy Rooney has to say about the state of American politics. So it's the same way. And then, you know, so it shows disrespect for the person who you're spreading false rumors around. And then you can think about the damage it might do when you say, oh, well, you know, American medicine, it's all about this cut and burn, and, you know, people should focus on holistic healing, right? And then pretty soon, like, maybe your friend gets the pancreatic cancer, and he's like, oh, I'll just, you know, I don't want to get surgery. That's, you know, that's Western medicine. That's evil. That's bad. That's just that cut and burn thing that Barbadale was talking about. I don't want to do that. I'm gonna go on a macrobiotic diet and see what that does. You know, and then like the cancer spreads, and you think, oh no, the cancer has spread into my lymph nodes. I better get surgery. And the doctor says, sorry, it's too late for that. I told you when you first came in that you need surgery right now. Otherwise, you're a dead duck, and you didn't listen to me. So, I mean, your beliefs can have that effect. And Clifford also says not only in a direct way, those are pretty direct examples, but even the direct form, if you just like, if your beliefs are formed the following way, here's an email from a friend that I know and trust, maybe for bad reasons. Therefore, everything in this email is probably trustworthy. I'm going to send it to all my friends who know and trust me. You know, then that's a bad way of forming beliefs, and that kind of sloppy thinking infects you and infects all your friends. And you know, these chain emails, they spread like a virus. Sometimes people send these superstitious emails. They have a bunch of stuff about. Usually, it's like sort of religious stuff, sort of New Agey sometimes. And it says, and send this to all your friends, and the good angel will bless you with, you know, health, wealth, and prosperity or something. If you don't, I can't be responsible for the consequences. And this is this kind of spiritual blackmail. Pardon me. Oh no, I didn't send that chain email and pay the consequences. I'll choke to death right here in class because instead of getting the good angel to bless me with good health, I got besought by the demon of non-forwarding a spammy chain emails to all my friends. So next time, and this is a lot of times people argue that philosophy is purely theoretical, that it builds no bridges and breaks no bread, makes no bread, builds no bridges and makes no bread. Well, here's a really practical application of philosophy. Critical and analytical thought. Next time you get some email that makes some fantastic claims it's from some celebrity and it's got some information, a bunch of statistics or whatever, just, you know, at the very least, just go to like Snopes.com and enter in a few keywords and see what pops up. And it might turn out that Obama isn't a Muslim. It might turn out that Mrs. Fields really isn't sending her cookie recipe around, and that Bill Gates is not going to give you $1 million for forwarding this email to all your friends. Did you have anything else?
No.
Okay, well, I'll see you at 4 o'clock.
Yep, Steve. Thanks, sir.
All right.
So that's essentially Clifford. Now, William James agrees with Clifford in a large part. So a lot of James' essay from McLean's magazine, I guess, is I think now defunct. But James' article is a reaction to Clifford. So you see at the beginning, James is talking about Clifford, is quoting him, and talking about Clifford's thesis. And in large measure, James agrees with Clifford that you should have evidence for your beliefs. So it's not as if James is saying, Clifford thinks you got to have all this evidence for your beliefs. And I say, you believe whatever you damn well believe. So that's not his view. I think that's kind of sort of Kierkegaard's view, but that's not James's view. So James says that most of the time, you should make sure your belief is founded on sufficient evidence. But there are some circumstances in which you don't need sufficient evidence, in which it's perfectly okay, and in which it's even a good thing that your belief is not founded upon sufficient evidence, and you believe anyway. So the first question is, what are those circumstances? And somebody want to give me a, we can take them in any order. So under what circumstances is it okay to believe something without enough evidence that any rational person would accept it as true?
Talking the genuine option.
Yeah. So you have to have he's talking about an option between one or more beliefs. So you're trying to decide what to believe.
So it has to be forced, meaning it's unavoidable. It has to be living, meaning willingness to act irrevocably, and it has to be momentous instead of trivial.
So three criteria for having the right to believe without sufficient evidence. So the three criteria for having the right, and in other words, to exercise your will to believe. Hence the title of the essay, The Will to Believe. So what do these mean? What do they mean for an option to be living? Somebody else, what's a living option as opposed to a dead option?
Something that moves and grows.
Well, living is something that lives and grows. So what does it mean when you're talking about a choice between two beliefs being alive? Well, it's a metaphor, right? So it's taking the metaphor of being alive, and then it's applying it to a choice between one or more beliefs. And you're like, well, I could believe this, I could believe that, I could believe this other thing. What do I believe? What does it mean to say that that choice of belief is a living choice as opposed to a dead choice?
A living choice is one that we actually consider, whereas a dead choice is something that is just so far out of our accepted worldview that it's not even possible to us.
Yeah, so you might say it's within the realm, of possibility. It's something that's possible for you to believe. Possibility. So, and this is a kind of a relative criteria. And what's it relative to?
Individual.
Yeah, but what makes it different for different individuals?
Yeah, like your current beliefs and largely your culture and your background.
So he gives us examples, right? And his examples are, you know, kind of might be kind of antiquated. Although today, like he's talking about the Muslims, right? So he's a Mohammedan. Is a sort of the old-timey term for it. Most Muslims, you call them Mohammedan, they wouldn't like that because they think Islam is more than Muhammad. Muhammad's just a revered prophet of the religion. He's not like Jesus, who's the savior of mankind. So, but he's talking about a Muslim, and he says a Muslim isn't likely to think that masses in holy water are, I think he used the term, efficacious. So in other words, if you got a guy who's a Muslim, he's not a Catholic, and you say, well, you ought to go to Mass and have, say, the priest sprinkle some holy water on you, and that'll be good for you. And what's a Muslim going to say about that?
Eat stuff.
Yeah, I'm just going to go to Friday prayer. That's that Catholic stuff. It doesn't make any sense to me. Right? Because he's raised a Muslim. He's familiar with Muslim rituals. He sees Catholicism as this contrary and foreign religion. And he sees no reason, he has no reason to believe that that would be beneficial to him. It's not within the realm of possibility. I have a friend who was raised as a kind of by parents who are from Eastern Europe, and they're sort of militant atheists. They believe that religion was the scourge of mankind, and that nothing good could come of it, and that people who believe in religion are like adults. They saw religion as sort of Santa Claus for adults. And so they raised him with this belief, and so he was raised with this belief. Not only did he have no religious background, but he was in a way inoculated to religious belief. He was raised to believe religious people were weak and stupid. So now the question is that really a live option for him to believe in some religious ideal? And I think James might say, well, you know, maybe not. Maybe, and this is kind of maybe an objection to James. James seems to think that belief in God is within the realm of possibility for everybody, and then it's sort of a living option. Depends on what form the religion takes. But you can imagine a person raised in kind of an atheistic culture or with an atheistic background that might, for them, the idea that Jesus rose from the dead might be similar to believing that Santa Claus really exists in their mind. That doesn't mean that Jesus didn't rise from the dead. It just means that for them, it's not a living option. To take another example, like a non-religious example, because I don't want to beg the question here about something which is something which wouldn't be a living option for you or for like some individual person. Well, there you go. Sickness is caused by spirits. There's people that believe that. For me, that's outside the realm of possibility. Well, I should say, okay, that all sickness is caused by spirits, I would say, is something that for most people living in modern technological cultures is not within the realm of possibility. Now, there are people in America that believe that. I used to have some friends that would get together on Friday nights and cast demons at each other and vomit into paper bags and, hold people down on the ground and yell at them and call the spirits out and stuff. But for most Americans, like that aren't raised in like that thing or don't become one of the part of those groups, it's just like that seems kind of crazy. And why is that? Well, it's because you're raised from the time you're so high, you go in there, you get your inoculation for various diseases, you learn about modern medicine. Maybe you get sick. What do your parents do? They take you to the doctor. Who's the doctor? He's the guy that makes you well, right? And then maybe mom. Had some medical problem. What does she do? She goes to the doctor. The doctor makes her all better. You're not feeling good at school. What do? You go to the school nurse. What does the school nurse do? Well, she like sprays this like chemically doctor stuff on the wound to make sure it doesn't get infected. Because what causes infection? Germs. What makes people sick? Germs, right? You put goop on your hands to keep the germs from spreading. Does goop protect against evil spirits? No, right? Is the teacher handing out little talismans and amulets for people to wear around their neck to scare away evil spirits? No. If you get sick at school, do they take to the witch doctor who puts on a scary mask and shakes a rattle and gives a magic chant? No. On the other hand, if you're raised in the Brazilian rainforest in the deepest, darkest part of the jungle, that's the way you're raised. And this idea, the idea of modern medicine might be equal to its form. So it's got to at least be possible for you to believe, for you to make a decision to believe something. And so James, in this way, I suppose, is a realist in thinking that given your pre-existing beliefs and the way you've developed as a person, there's some things that you just, like, it's going to seem crazy that if someone offers a belief up to you, it's got to bear some resemblance to the beliefs you already have, and those are largely picked up by your culture and background. Okay, so that's what it is for the option to be living. So that's the first criteria. Relative to culture background and pre-existing beliefs. So it's got to fit in with your current system. Now, sometimes a big belief might come and like a sort of momentous belief might come and just shatter your whole belief structure, and you think, well, this thing seems to have a lot of evidence for it. If you're thinking about it in terms of evidence, sometimes a belief can overturn a person's belief system if they accept it. But if you're thinking about, remember, we're talking about a belief which you don't have enough evidence for. So then that's a lot dicier to say this belief which has no evidence is going to counteract all these other beliefs you have which do have a lot of evidence. That seems unlikely. And that's why James says it has to at least kind of cohere with your pre-existing beliefs. What is it for an option to be forced? Is it for someone to put a gun to your head and say, believe or else, or what?
When somebody tries to tell you that this is what you should believe, and you don't believe this, then
okay, now that's like that's a forced belief in like the ordinary concept, you might say a forced belief, like someone trying to shove a belief down your throat. But that's actually not what James means when he says forced. He uses this in a slightly different context, or in a different way. When he's talking about forced, it's a belief you're forced to do, not by a person, but sort of based on circumstance. Yeah?
I think he's talking about having choices between two things, and if you don't buy into it, nothing happens. And by buying into one side of it, you're obligated to that decision, like going outside with the umbrella or not, and not go outside. So.
Yeah, there are consequences for the belief, you know, and for not acting on it. But these could be either trivial or momentous. So don't conflate this with the momentous criteria. So the idea it will pour rain. It will pour rain and hail today. Now, the weather is one of those things that you don't have ice up there. Oh, it looks like it's hailing right now. Look at that.
Yeah.
That
poor guy with the hoodie out there. Walking in like it's not. It kind of looks like snow, but it's kind of slushy snow.
The periods of slushy snow. Now, if you're the umbrella-toting sort, as I am,
I think I had this talk with one of the psychology professors. We were trying to think, okay, well, why is it certain people, they carry umbrellas, and other people, they, like, wear the hoodies, or they just sort of walk around in it like it's nothing? And I think glasses is one thing. You get, like, spots over your glasses, and it's sort of a pain. So I think that's one reason. The hoodie kind of protects, but not a lot. It also, you know, people from California, Oregon has a lot of California transplants, and California people tend to be the umbrella toting sorts because they're not used to rain, and when it does rain, they don't like it. They're kind of like cats in that respect, not like getting wet. Whereas Oregon, native Oregonians are more like that. Anyhow, so you're deciding, should I, you know, wear a rain gear, or bring an umbrella, bring my hoodie, you know, maybe put my stuff, you know, bring my waterproof backpack, bring my art satchel so my artwork doesn't get all wet, whatever. So you're trying to decide whether to prepare, like reading an umbrella. Well, when you walk out the door, if you walk out the door with a belief it'll rain today, and don't bring your umbrella, or it won't rain today, and for that reason don't want to take your umbrella, then you're going to get caught in the rain. So then this has a consequence in that if you don't follow through the belief that it's going to pour rain today, then you're going to get all wet. Now, it's a trivial consequence, probably, so. But still, you're forced in that you can't say, well, maybe it'll rain, maybe it won't. Because whatever you decide is true, or likely to be true, is going to have a consequence for you. Now, I think James would say, given that the weather is uncertain, you sort of have to take a leap of faith in deciding what is probably true with insufficient evidence. And so he thinks that's one of the criteria. So the idea is that if you don't make a decision right now or in the near future, there's going to be consequences. Either little consequences or maybe big consequences, but there's going to be some effect. Now, what would be one that's not forced? What would be a belief that would be the opposite of force?
Love me or hate me.
love your hate. So, well, it depends on like who the person is, I think.
Because then you could either love or hate or just not give an opinion.
But it might depend on who the person is, though. Right? I want this a little more clear and illustrated. That might be coming to your CL. Okay, how about like who shot JFK? Right, so think about, okay, now I like all this sort of conspiracy stuff. I think it's very interesting. I don't find a lot of the conspiracy theories. The JFK stuff, and I think there are a lot of interesting aspects of that. Now, does it make a difference to my life and to what will befall me in the coming month that I make a decision about whether there was a conspiracy to shoot JFK or whether Lee Harvey Oswald acted alone?
No.
Yeah, there's no effect at all, right? So, a lot of political beliefs are like this, though. Now, there's some that have import. Like, now, what if I'm... Let's assume that, like, voting has some effect on, who runs the political entities we have, such as they are, and who's in charge, and what sort of policies they have. All right, so you're trying to decide... who should I vote for? Then that has an effect, right? And it's a forced choice, because if you haven't decided by the time the election comes around who you should vote for, then either you're not going to vote, you're going to have to guess, or you have to make some decision. So because the election has a deadline, you have to decide before the election whether you're going to vote, and if you're going to vote, who you're going to vote for. So that's a practical, that's again a practical decision. If you wait until the election is passed, there's a consequence, namely your vote isn't counted and you don't get to make your contribution, however small, in who will get the opportunity to write laws and order you about. So any questions on what a forced option is? You got to make a decision now, although you can't put it off. And I suppose this is you can't put it off. That's a big part of this. You can't put it off, without missing out on something, negative effect. Again, they don't have to be big at that. So you might think, well. It's one vote out of 150 million for president. It's one vote out of, I don't know how many registered voters there are in Oregon, and how many of those people vote, say 100,000 or something for the state races. It's me out of 5,000 people for voting in the Grove for a mayor. And it might be that, Gary Williams and the challenger, would do pretty much the same thing, so maybe it doesn't make any difference. But if it does make a difference, and if I want my vote to count, I got to vote before the election. Okay, now how about momentous? What does that mean?
Life or death decision?
Yeah, so it's like of great importance. The JFK assassination, I'd say it's a matter of history, and I'd say I would think it's of low importance, in part because most of the people who would have been involved are either in old age homes or dead. They're not in positions of political power. But take like another conspiracy, like these 9/11 conspiracies, like in the Zeitgeist movie, and some of these loose chains, these documentaries floating around that say 9/11 was an inside job and Building 7 was a controlled demolition. Now, if those things are really true, it seems that those have some import. They say something about the nature of the government and sort of what it's up to. So you might say that's momentous, but maybe not forced, in that if I don't make a decision about it tomorrow, it's not going to have a big effect on me. And there's not like sort of an artificial, some sort of deadline imposed on me making a decision.
What about something a little more momentous, like, okay, suppose I find out I have cancer, and I'm going to try to decide my course of treatment. And I can choose, I can choose surgery and chemo and radiation, or I can try, a psychic surgery in Haiti, where some of my guys probably going to use chicken blood and sleight of hand to make it look like he's, sticking his hands into my body with the, with no scalpel or anything. Or I could go on like a restricted vegan diet and drink a lot of distilled water. Right? Now it would be momentous in the sense that it's my life. It is a real life event situation. It's also forced in that I can't put it off, because if I put it off, my cancer will spread and my chance of survival will go down. And now the question about whether it's living, and again, this is going to depend on my background. If I know about science, or I've read up a lot on like the holistic health movement, and then maybe it's not a living option. Or I suppose you might like a fourth thing, like my faith healing, right? I could go down to my church, or go to like my New Age meditation group and have them all either pray for healing, or have them send positive vibrations my way or something, right? So I could do a number of things. It would be forced, because now you have to decide, otherwise the cancer is going to get you, and it's momentous and life and death. How about another example? Let's take one more so we know which of each of these are. Can you think of something which is momentous but not forced?
You get a chance to climb Mount Everest, but you have to decide you did.
Yeah, so that would be, I know it might be both, it would be forced, right? Because you have to, sign up before the deadline.
Yeah,
but I think it would also be momentous in that, then climbing Mount Everest is kind of a cool thing. It's also life and death. A lot of people die trying to climb Mount Everest. The corpses are still up there because, they don't decay in the snow. It's tough just to like climb up and down. Just taking the bodies down is so dangerous that if you go try to retrieve the bodies, you're likely to leave more bodies there. You pile up more than you leave. It's like,
maybe they could build a human igloo or something.
Yeah, I suppose you could do that. It's kind of morbid. There's a really interesting article I read on the people that climb Mount Everest. You get to a certain point where, you can only survive a certain amount of time because of the cold and the thin air. You need, oxygen. You need to bring your own oxygen.
There's trash everywhere.
Yeah.
Because they climb up there and then they just abandon stuff in order to reach the top, and nobody takes it down, so it just piles up.
Your will to recycle goes down when you're thinking about whether you're going to be able to take your next breath or not. Okay, so, but what might be, can you think of an example of something, this is kind of hard, something momentous, but it's not forced. So forced but not momentous would be like the umbrella. Well, momentous but not forced, something that's really important, but you don't have to decide now. Yeah.
Well, every day I choose between the gas, the brake, and the clutch. And that's pretty momentous, but it's not. I guess that would be forced.
That would be forced too, though, right? That might be forced. I suppose it's momentous depending on, where you are. If you're in your driveway or, a deserted parking lot, maybe not. If you're driving in traffic, then it's pretty momentous. Yeah.
Career choice or something.
Yeah, career choice. That's an excellent example. So you don't have to decide what you're going to do for the rest of your life right now. Now, at a certain point, you're going to miss out on things. Like if you wait till you're 40 and you're just kind of meandering through life and haven't decided what you want to do, then that might be a problem. But it's not like if you take a couple of years to find yourself and maybe, off in trains or riding the rails and, riding those bullet trains in Europe with your backpack, staying at the youth hostels, and doing character sketches on the street corner for spending money. That's not going to kill you. And it's not like you have to decide right now.
Yeah, so that's a good example. So that would be momentous. Like, what are you going to do with your life? That's a moment. That's really momentous. What are you going to do for your to make a living? And then there's, but it's not forced in that. If you wait a while, no bad things will befall you. Now, what's James? James thinks that in order to exercise your will to believe, you need to use all three of these.
And remember, these are decisions that you're making without sufficient evidence. So the idea is, what would be the best career for me?
You might think, well, I got a lot of talents. I've got this talent and that talent, and or there might be, if I did this, I might really like it. But if I did this, I might like it even more. So you try. So maybe you're just kind of like, I'm not really sure where I should go. And what I should do. Well, you can put it off, and maybe you should explore the one thing. Like you're thinking about, this is what Paul Haggis did. He's the guy that had that Scientology article, and this guy was bouncing around in his 20s. He was working for his father's construction company. He went to film school, dropped out. He decided he wanted to be a fashion photographer, and he went over to Paris and was doing fashion shoots for about 6 months, and then he dropped out of that, came back, and he was just bouncing all over the place doing all manner of different things. And now he's one of the most famous writer producers in Hollywood, and makes money off, makes lots and lots of money, feels really, really fulfilled, really enjoys his work, is ultra successful. Was that affected by the fact that he kicked around in his early 20s, and I think maybe he didn't get into the movie biz till his late 20s, and finally kind of made it big, right? He started writing television in his late 20s, and that's where his career kind of took off. It might even have helped him, right? And he was able to explore those different things. So career choice, momentous, but not forced. Momentous, but not forced. Or is the Everest thing is forced and momentous? What about making a decision to climb Mount Everest with your own team? All right, so that's not really a choice. In other words, in James's example, you have an opportunity to go with a group who's already going to climb Mount Everest. It's like the that's different than having your own expedition. In your own expedition, you pretty much go anytime you want. You should probably go before you're in your 50s to make sure you're in good physical condition. It's probably better to go before you hit the in your mid 40s or something, just to make sure that you're physically up to the task. But it's not like you have to go any particular time or there's some deadline other than, when you're starting to lose your health or something. All right, so now what about the God hypothesis? How does the God hypothesis, again, we're talking about, can you believe in something without sufficient evidence? James assumes that there isn't sufficient evidence for believing God.
We call this the religious hypothesis. So, is it living? what does James say about whether it's living or not? James says it is. So he's actually. James says that it meets all three of these criteria: living, forced, and momentous.
Apart from my friend the militant atheist and maybe people that grew up in certain countries.
Even for the militant atheist, it has to be living. I mean, if he's militant, if he's constantly defending it, then he wouldn't be fighting against something that he doesn't consider to be real. He would just be fighting against something he considers to be wrong.
Yeah, so I suppose that if you're militant, that might show that you're sort of hostile to religion. Maybe there's a, that methinks thou dost protest too much thing going on there. And even you get people like Madeline Murray O'Hare, the founder of the American Atheists. Her son ended up becoming an evangelical Christian and a minister. So, and this is like the son of America's best known atheist at the time. This is like, she had her heyday, I guess, in the 80s and 90s, and then it turned out that she was like murdered by some of her... she was murdered by someone who wanted access to like all the money she squirreled away, and was sort of disappeared, and we could finally figure out what happened to her. So, so it was a strange case. So anyway, living. Well, let's go with that. Momentous. Yeah, you know, if there's a God, it seems to have a pretty big impact on your life, right? The idea that there is a, that you have a creator who created the world and everything in it. I don't know, what do you think? People want to argue that believing God isn't momentous. What if I have the idea that, well, I'll just sort of coast through life and I'll find out if there's a God when I die or I won't. Like, if there's nothing, if there's no afterlife, then it's like, maybe I'll never know. Yeah.
I think it would depend on the extent of your belief. If you're a deist, then it's not momentous. But if you're an evangelical Christian, then that's what would be momentous.
Right, so just to repeat so people listen to the recording can hear that.
That was a very low waveform. So if you're... if you're a deist, then to you, God is sort of an abstraction or a kind of a philosophical posit, then maybe it might not have that much effect on your behavior if you do believe in God. And we'll actually come to Pascal's wager in a minute here. So, but you can think, like, it, you know, is it momentous? Does it really matter whether you believe in God? Some people think, well, you know, I'll figure that out when I die, or maybe when I'm in the old age and I'm all dead. You know, start thinking about this stuff. Right now, I'm young, and death is a long ways off. I suppose you might get hit by a bus or something. And it might make a difference if there's an afterlife, and what you do in this life depends on what fate will befall you in the next. So that might be a reason why it would be momentous. So, and then James also says, and you know, why does James says, he also says it's force. Well, that's kind of a, and this actual, it's easy to conflate the living and force. Notice I was sort of, I started talking about momentous, and I was talking about, we'll all kind of put it off. And it's easy to conflate, because most of these things, you can see how, if something is momentous, it's the sort of thing you're not going to put off, it seems. And if something's forced, you know, may or may not be momentous. But momentous things tend also to be forced, and that if it's something that's super important, not doing anything about it now seems that it would create a case where you miss out on something. So if something's super important, not doing anything about it now would usually, it would seem, lead to some sort of loss. But you can separate these out in your mind, like the case of your choice. So so James says, therefore, it's okay to believe in God without sufficient evidence. Why? Well, what about this fourth thing? What do you miss out on?
Consequences.
Yeah, but then what? Like, the consequences maybe after you die, but what about in this life?
Changes your ability to participate in social organizations like the church or dinners or neighborhood stuff that you'd be doing through the church. So you want just your immediate effect on your neighbors and your neighborhood.
The fellowship of believers, so this sort of social thing, sure. He also says things like hope and meaning. The hope of eternal life. The idea that God exists and created you for a purpose. And if you go through your life thinking this is one glorious accident, and that I'm a product of unthinking naturalistic forces, and that my life has no meaning, and it ends at death, James thinks that's a despair-inspiring view. And you have no hope of an afterlife. When your friends and loved ones who have died are in the ground and you will never see them again.
and that's kind of a bleak, from Jane's point of view, is a bleak outlook. And so if you think your life is meaningless and you have no hope for the future beyond death, then he thinks that's, it makes life look kind of futile and pointless and meaningless. Whereas if you have religious belief, James says, even if it turns out that it's a bunch of hooey and there is no God, no afterlife, at least you have that meaning and you have that meaning and you have an idea that your life has a purpose. And that is extremely valuable, to live life with hope, without anxiety about death, without worry about the future, to have some sense that your life matters in a sort of cosmic way, as opposed to the fact that you're a naked ape, highly adept at tool using, right? Which is a sort of the modern kind of secular humanistic idea. It's like, well, you have the sort of the ancient earth, and you have the piles of chemicals rubbing against each other, and they create friction that causes static electrical discharge. A lightning bolt into the cosmic ooze, all this, the prebiotic soup, with all these chemicals floating around, and that created the amoebas, and the cosmic rays came down, and the amoebas mutated the paramecium, and pretty soon you got all these different forms of sea life, and then some fish start flopping onto the shore and kind of learn to flop, and then pretty soon you have amphibians, and you've got your reptiles and birds and mammals, and they form adaptive social organizations, and you get troops of primates living in the trees, and then they become adapt to moving around, walking upright on the savannah. And then pretty soon you have human beings who are really good at tool using, and we come up with agriculture, and then we have a class of people that don't have to work all day for food. And then it's a short period of time, relatively speaking, in the vast history of the world, from farmers to factories to finally spaceships and genetic engineering and all that stuff. But it all just started with the static electrical discharge and some chemical interactions. And you're still this bag of chemicals that can walk and talk. And James says that's the idea that your life has no purpose and meaning, and that it's despair provoking. But if you have a religious idea that you have a creator who made you, loves you, and is kind of looking out for you, that he has a purpose for your life, and that your meaning is to be found in the service of other people, in helping people, in making the world better, and that in the afterlife you'll be with God, and God's going to explain to you why you went all through all this trouble. That's kind of like a hope-inspiring life. And if you go through your life as an agnostic, you're going to miss out on all that meaning and hope. So what do you think? Any thoughts on that? Move on to Pascal's wager. Yeah.
Couldn't you just be content with humanistic ideas? I mean, it's an assertion that you're going to live in despair. It's going to be all bleak and stuff. So, subjective.
Yeah. So, the question is, couldn't you get the same meaning elsewhere, in some place other than God? So it was sort of a humanistic meaning. If people have this idea, like this idea of the moral life or the ethical life, there's people who are atheists, like Peter Singer, and he believes in utilitarianism, which is, I'll say the symbol, Peter Singer. And actually, people have written about this. Who's that other guy? Sam Harris. Both these guys kind of left leaders, especially Sam Harris. He wrote this book, Letter to a Christian Nation. But Sam Harris has this book about faith. It's called, is it The Ethics of Faith? The Ethics of... He has some book on morality where he tries to show that basically that you can have a meaningful life without believing God. And I don't think it's very good. But at least it's an attempt to do that. And a lot of people have this idea, like Peter Singer and Sam Harris and some of these other humanists, they say, well, I believe in making the world a better place. And these religious people, they're focused on the afterlife, and they're kind of ignoring all the problems we have today and maybe even causing them. And rather than focus on the hereafter, which will never come, I'm going to focus on my life now. And the meaning of my life now is in, and you know, people have to have scientific discovery, creating great works of art and literature, creating institutions which for the betterment of mankind. And those are the sort of humanist values. And so the one objection to this might be that you can sort of have meaning outside of religion. And then, you know, what about the afterlife? Well, you know, people think that maybe, you know, the science can end aging, or they're going to get frozen and reanimated, or what have you. Or maybe but genetic engineering will future technology will allow them to live an immortal existence eventually. So, and this kind of goes to, let's talk about Pascal's wager for a minute here. Because James actually takes this up. So
I got a question.
Yeah.
Talking about meaning, is meaning something intrinsic or is it something given? Like, is it a property?
That's a good question.
I mean, because if you go to the humanist path, it seems to say that if I give myself meaning, then all meaning is relative. If there's no objective meaning, then who's to say that my meaning actually counts for anything?
That's a good question, but then if you look at thinking about James's idea that if you believe in God and it turns out there isn't one, you still would have led a meaningful life. That seems to treat meaning as a subjective thing. Right? And that if it benefited you, or is it that you only thought you had meaning? This is kind of a couple, there might be a couple layers here, but I think you might say that James's idea of meaning is a sort of subjective idea of having a sense of purpose that infuses your life with hope and the fact that your life matters, that it has value because of your religious beliefs. And then James says, if it turns out that your beliefs are all false and they weren't backed up by evidence and it turns out you guessed wrong, then you still get all those benefits in that having those false beliefs actually benefited you in a number of ways. It made you, it made your life happier. It made you healthier. It gave you a bunch of friends who gathered around a common cause. And so you might have had better relationships, less anxiety. And again, I think I've mentioned in the past that they've done all these demographic studies of religious people, and they seem to live better lives across the board as far as their functional relationships, as far as subjective feelings of happiness, and being free from psychological problems and turmoil in their life, and substance abuse, and so on and so forth. But that's kind of a subjective sense of meaning.
But that's based on the idea if there isn't a God.
Yeah. Now, if there is a God,
and it's obviously objective,
then you have that objective meaning. And so, but wouldn't you have that objective meaning even if you didn't believe in God?
I don't think how you could.
Well, you just wouldn't have a. You wouldn't have a cosmic belief. I mean, you wouldn't have a. You would have a cosmic sense of meaning. You just wouldn't believe it. Right? I mean, if there's a God and he created you and he has a plan for your life, but you don't believe it, then it seems like you still, that all those things are still true. It's just that you're not cognizant of them. So you would have a subjectively meaningless life, even your life would be meaningful. But what you would miss out on is the benefits of the belief, not the benefits of the meaning, because you have that rehearsal whether you accept it or not.
Okay, so I'm sorry, I'm just beating this to death, I guess, but let's take God out of the equation, so there is no God. How would you justify meaning as being objective if there's no object in comparison?
Yeah, Alicia, so how do you have objective meaning?
So, just understanding that we're all part of an ecosystem and there is this larger life than ourselves, so we're all individuals that contribute to this, then that gives us an objective meaning to the ecosystem.
But
outside of ourselves, so we may not know it. We may not have that.
I see you're placing value in that, but could it be equally justified if I thought that helping myself is the best thing to do? I mean, you want to say help everybody else, and you can believe that, but would it be equally valued if I said I want to help myself in every way that I can?
But the individual is a part of the whole, and so we have to cultivate the individual to be a responsible, healthy part of the whole.
But what if I value the individual greater than the whole? Am I wrong?
No, I don't think so, because either way, you're going to have the effects you have in the world, and it's going to influence the ecosystem, and then whatever your actions are going to have some meaning to that ecosystem.
Well, sure, I agree. It's going to affect either way. You're going to affect everybody, no matter if you think that your worth is greater than everybody else, or if you think everybody else is greater than yours. Mm-hmm. But the problem I have is trying to place an equal value in one person as being greater than everybody else, or everybody greater than one person. I don't see how you can figure out which one is greater if you don't have any object in comparison. Like, it's just like this continual circle of, like, you'll say that you're better than everybody else, and everybody else will say that everything is better than you, and you don't really have anything to base it on. So it seems like it's all relative.
Why do you need this hierarchy? To say that one is better than the other.
Well, because if you don't have anything that's objective and everything is relative, then it's like this trickle, like this effect. If everything is relative, then me doing something that you would consider morally wrong isn't necessarily morally wrong.
I think I always think about, like, if meaning is to be found in being in harmony with nature and the people that are paving over the rainforest, they might have meaning to their actions, but it's like a bad meaning. Right, they're doing something wrong, and so that. But if you're like Ayn Rand, one time said that rather than, like, when she looks out at a forest, she just sort of, you know, it's like, well, yeah, I guess it's nice. But she looks at a skyscraper and she's like, now that's something, right? That's, you know, that. Whereas, like, the people that have their ecological thing, they're like, the size skyscraper is kind of like a monstrosity, and they look at the nature of the rainforest, and they're like, oh, it's so beautiful, and it's so meaningful. So those are, like, two, views in opposition. And the idea that the people that are building the skyscrapers and say, hey, if you have to knock down a few trees, you know, and make a few species go extinct, you know, Mother Earth will get over it. But they're doing something wrong. So that's just the idea that you still might have meaning, but if our meaning is to be found in the ecosystem, then you might say understanding that meaning is important. You think about, I suppose, if you're going to go for that kind of ecological meaning, you think about, well, you know, in the ecosystem, man is a predator. So you might think, well, if what human beings do is, you know, prey on the lower animals, then, you know, what's wrong with factory farming? Or you kind of think about the sort of, or what's wrong with the conquering other countries? Mm-hmm.
And there I would say, you know, if it sacrifices the life of the ecosystem, then there is entirely bad meaning in that, because the individual will never survive if we don't have an ecosystem to support it.
That may be true.
The main problem I have is moral subjectivity. I mean, is morality essentially right and wrong, differentiating between what's okay, what's beneficial to mankind, versus what's bad, what's not beneficial mankind? And the problem I have is, if you take away anything that's objective, then you don't really have something to base what's right and what's wrong. Everything is equally right, equally wrong. So the problem I have with taking out an object such as a moral figure, regardless if you believe in it or not, I mean, just the idea of God alone creates like an apex of moral authority. Regardless of believing, but the fact that it's there helps you to differentiate between what's right and wrong. It helps us create laws. Murder's wrong because it takes away life. Well, we value life. Why do we value life? Because life has a higher purpose. Who gives us that purpose? A higher being, a universe, whatever you want to call it. But as long as there's something objective, then you can have objective morality at saying things are right and saying things are wrong. But as soon as you make everything subjective, then there's no distinction between right and wrong.
So if, even if you have a meaning, if that meaning, if you're talking about the pragmatic, remember, James is a pragmatist, and maybe this will be a good way to segue to this. So James is known for this view called pragmatism, and his idea is not like, is the belief true? If you can't figure out whether the belief is true, you ask the second question. Is the belief useful or beneficial? And I think this is a kind of a relativist view in a way, in that James says, first you should try to prove something. If you can't prove it, then you got to make a decision. You can believe it anyway. You can, or you can withhold your assent. You can be an agnostic about it. And James says that someone like Descartes might say that you should only believe those things you have sufficient evidence for. Someone like Clifford would say the same thing. Only believe those things that you can prove. But James says, wait a minute, you can't prove everything in life, and there are certain things that are really important that you can't prove that you should believe anyway. And his example, religion might be one case. Think about like starting a business, right? Starting a business is a risky proposition. And you don't know when you start a business that you're going to succeed. And you're probably not sure that your marketing plan will win. You don't know that you will have sufficient funding. You can't predict what the economy is going to do, right? You can have some educated guesses, but you can't really prove it. But you have to sort of take that step of faith where you say, okay, well, I think this is probably the way things are going to go. I have confidence in myself and my abilities. I have faith in my idea. I'm going to step out and do my best and see what happens. And James thinks this is the same case with religion, in that even if you can't prove that God exists, he thinks that you would be better off in making that, believing it anyway, because you're going to win either way, and that you will get all these benefits of being a religious person, a person of faith, that you would miss out on otherwise. And so that's why he thinks that God fulfills all three of these criteria, and that you should believe without evidence. Maybe do a quick segue to Pascal's wager, which is discussed in James' article. So Pascal, again, starts with James's premise. And Pascal's quite a bit earlier than James. Pascal's right in the 16th or 17th century. So Blaise Pascal, famous mathematician, had this thing he called the wager. It's an argument for God's existence, and it's a pragmatic argument. And he says there's either two possibilities: God exists or God doesn't exist, one or the other. And then there's two attitudes you can adopt: either believe or don't believe. And don't believe includes like a positive disbelief, and also being agnostic, of not making the decision to believe. And so he says, what happens, you think about this as a wager, and there's four possible outcomes. So, and you don't know for sure, so you're going to bet on which of these things is true. What are the stakes? Your eternal existence. And so, what if you believe, what if it turns out that God exists and you believe? Then he says, you get infinite gain. So that's the sign for infinity there, sign of the gate. Infinite gain. You might, in terms of the betting world, you hit the jackpot. You win the lottery, right? The big payoff. Big win. And what happens if you believe and God doesn't exist? Well, he says, you have a finite gain. You win some. And what you have, and he says again, you get the benefits of the religious life. You have a sense of hope for the future. You have a sense of meaning. You have a little bit of a sort of support to make moral decisions. When you're, instead of being selfish, and always thinking about yourself, you go to church and talks about love your neighbor and and try to be, you know, try to be like Jesus and serve your fellow man. You're thinking, oh, okay, I guess I shouldn't be so selfish. And so he thinks that, and then there's other stuff about, and you know, if you do X, Y, and Z, God's going to punish you, and you think, oh, I ought to get my act together. Whereas if you didn't have that religious component, you might be a worse sort of person morally, according to Pascal.
So then, also, if you think the other alternatives, what if you don't believe, and it turns out God doesn't exist? Well, here, you break even. So, no loss.
But you have the most to lose, too. If God exists, and you don't believe in it.
Well, so what happens if God exists and you don't believe in it? So there, he says that this is where you lose everything. You have infinite loss, and here's where you lose your shirt. Right here, you pocket $30,000 to the casino, and you know Guido's coming out to ask for payment. Otherwise, he's gonna break your kneecaps, and then next week he's gonna bear you out. You're gonna be one of those hundreds of mounds out there in the Nevada desert. Right, so so God's gonna punish you or send you to hell or something. And so that's, you know, infinite loss. And so now, given these odds, what kind of idiot would you be to bet on the don't believe, right? What's the best you can do if you don't believe?
Break even.
The best you can do is break even. Who would take a bet like that? What if I said, I'm gonna make you a bet, and I bet you that it's gonna snow tomorrow. If it doesn't snow, nothing happens. If it does snow, you pay me $500. Who would take that bet? That would be a stupid bet. Because you don't stand anything in the game. So that would be a bad bet for you to make. Now what about if you bet on God, what are your chances of winning something? Yeah, well, you're gonna win something, right? So you can't lose here, because here the best you can do is break even. Here the worst you can do is gain some, right? So it's like going to Vegas and they're like, well, you either hit the jackpot or you get $100 just for coming down. And even if you end up losing, we'll make sure that you walk out of the doors with $100. You know, that would be a great casino, at least from the point of view of the patrons. Probably wouldn't be around very long. So so things really would be luckier there. But not at your regular casino. So so what do you think about this argument? Thoughts?
I think basing a belief solely on the consequences is, I don't know, irrational.
Irrational?
Like,
well,
not irrational, but like
immoral.
Yeah, that would probably fit it best. It completely immoral, basing a belief system off of consequences or outcomes. It's just dumb.
It seems like some sort of treating belief in God is kind of like fire insurance or something.
Yeah. So what if you go through this whole mindset and you're like, okay, I'm gonna believe that God exists, and then.
Uh-huh.
You believe that God exists, and you live your life, and then you die, and you know you show up at St. Peter, and Peter's like, "Yeah, well, I mean, you believed it, we didn't follow, so you're heading down that way." So, man.
If he said, St. Peter says what?
I'm just saying, what if the belief itself doesn't actually get you anywhere?
Oh, I see. Like, you see St. Peter there, and you're like, "Oh, where's the Buddha? I was expecting to see the Buddha." And St. Peter says, "Sorry, you're going to the other place."
No, I'm saying, what if you believe in God that you choose not to follow?
So he's talking about belief of the mind instead of a belief of the heart.
It's like I believe that there could be a God figure, but I mean I'm not sure if I should ascribe to Judaism or Christianity.
I have a separate question, like which as soon as you believe in God, like which. It's not like you just have to believe in a kind of generic God. There are all these different religions out there, and you have to see so you pick
But that's
one.
Like the first question you have to answer.
But that's the connection that you have to make.
Well,
okay.
James seems to assume that all religions are pretty much the same. You just believe in God, you just kind of pick the one that matches your sofa or something.
Don't they pretty much all say that the other ones are wrong?
Yeah, that's the problem.
So by law of non-contradiction, one of them has to be right, if any are right.
Yeah. As you had a comment.
I was just going to say, it kind of seems like almost like religious blackmail as far as like the email example you gave at the beginning.
Oh, yeah. Huh?
It kind of seems like it's just the same thing. I mean, if you believe on solely on this reason, you're just believing in fear of consequences or in fear of losing somewhere. Like, you don't even know if the boxes are accurate, you know?
Yeah, is God going to really reward spiritual gamblers? And, you know, if it is that like, good job, you picked the right, you bet it on black instead of red, you know. That seems kind of nutty. But the other question you might ask is God really going to punish you for guessing wrong? If it's really true that the evidence is ambiguous, it doesn't seem like a just God to really punish someone for making a wrong guess. Imagine, like, if I said, you know, if I said, you know, in the last 2 minutes of class, there's a pop quiz. Those who get the question right get, you know, they get a letter grade. Their grades bump a letter. And if you get the question wrong, you fail. And then the question is, you know, what's the capital of Assyria? Right? Or something like that. Or suppose I said, what's my favorite color?
Blue. Right? No, wait.
Yeah, so I mean, if I said, like, and you had, like, no idea that the quiz was coming, and you had no idea, like, no basis on which to guess, like, what my favorite color was, you might, like, look at my shirt or my pants, and you try to find something, you see what color marker I'm wearing. I mean, there might be some evidence, but it would, like, be a big guess. You might have hearsay from other people about what I wanted. But, you know, and then you might say that that's the case that the person trying to figure out which religion to pick would be in. And James actually says it's the reason why you're betting, or Pascal says the reason why you're betting in the first place is you don't know. Then there's not sufficient evidence to find out. Last comment.
Well, concerning, like, if this is his pragmatism is based on if you don't have evidence.
Right.
So I guess then you wouldn't necessarily have to beg that question for other religions, because you could just look at the evidence and find if there were any internal contradictions, and then you could rule them out on those basis alone.
Yeah, so you might object to the whole idea. You might say, well, maybe there is a way to figure out the truth about God or which religion is right, and you can do that on the basis of evidence, which the argument of the pragmatic arguments assume is not possible. Okay, we're moving on to Kierkegaard on Monday. I will get the topics up right after class. I know I've been pokey about those. And you can, since next Monday, actually next Monday is a holiday, right? There's no class next Monday. We'll be talking about Kierkegaard next Wednesday. And you can have till Tuesday to post, since we have a holiday weekend coming up.
Oh, yeah. Procrastination.